Welcome to the Trino Community Broadcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome once again to the Trino Community Broadcast. We have episode 64. My name is Cole Bowden. Joining me, as always, is Manfred Moser. Manfred, how are you doing today?
Good, good. I just got out of the Trino Contributor call, and there were like a lot of awesome, really great discussions. And even though there weren't many of us, there were many mighty attendees. It was great. We had good discussions, and things are always moving forward in Trino land, so it's been great.
Yeah, lots of conversation about the work on the new Trino UI, which is pretty exciting stuff. I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes, but we'll talk about that a little later, I think.
Yeah.
For now, we can talk about what this episode is, which is discussing Open Policy Agent with Trino. This is an integration that's been getting built out as a collaboration in the community for much of the last year, I think, is when it showed up about this time last year was when we first heard of it. But it's been getting better, more robust, and it's kind of one of the best ways to handle access control these days. So,
yeah, it's been amazing. Been presented at Trino Summit last time by Stackable. Sebastian and Sönke are joining us today. And the folks at Bloomberg, Pablo and Eric, mostly involved there, collaborating very efficiently on that. And obviously, Dane orchestrating the reviews and everything, so our security experts. So it's been really good, and there's more been going on in terms of new features, and they're gonna show us this all in the real world, which is always great to see, right? Like, it's all interesting to have a feature implemented, and but then like how is it actually being used is the real interesting part. So we'll learn a lot about that today, so it should be great. But yep. Before that, Cole, what are we gonna do?
We got to catch up on what's been going on in Trino over the last few weeks.
Let's do that.
We need you to scroll down, Manfred.
I thought you were going to give us a banner, but okay,
fine. Oh, I can do that. Hold on. I have a banner.
Yay!
There we go. My bad. We do that while you're scrolling.
All right, cool. So we have released Trino 4.54 since the last release, which actually turned out to be a fairly big release, and I think 4.55 is in the pipeline, but since so much went into 4.54, not much went into 4.55 just yet. So we'll talk about that next time because it hasn't actually been released yet. So what happened in 4.54, Cole?
Yeah, so 4.54 ended up taking a little while to come out. There were some new configuration options added that were then removed. So the negotiation and discussion in that meant that more features were just landing all the time while we were discussing. So in 4.54, we have improved performance for queries that contain multiple aggregation functions. There's a new Kafka Event Listener plugin, undocumented, which is a little unfortunate because there's no instructions on how to use it yet.
It's coming there. Though. Like I'm pushing people and I might end up having to do some of it myself. But an Event Listener plugin, what that is, remember, is basically Qmiro spits out and does a whole bunch of like information about every query it processes. The Event Listener plugin is something that allows you to pump that info somewhere else. We have a HTTP one, we have a MySQL one, we have one for Open. No, I forgot Open. Anyway, we have another one, and now we have one for the popular Kafka. So basically, every query event, like query completed, query started, can be into going into a Kafka topic and then go crazy in the Kafka ecosystem, which is cool.
Yeah, so this is for the Trino administrators out there. If you want more data about how your cluster is being used, you want to do some telemetry or analytics on what queries are being run, et cetera, the Event Listener now can publish events to Kafka, and you can use that instead of the other Event Listeners. Yeah. We added configuration for fetch size with JDBC-based connectors. This is like a pretty under-the-hood change, also not yet documented.
We're negotiating if it should be documented at the moment.
Yeah, it's something that you shouldn't be changing if you don't know what you're doing. But if you really do know what you're doing, this can be used to modify the like block sizes from the JDBC connectors. So it can be pretty powerful and change the way Trino behaves. We added support for writing deletion vectors with Delta Lake. We added a new resources tab in the web interface with data from a new query endpoint. Also not very documented, which is why we're spelling out that query endpoint extremely explicitly. But that's pretty cool. It contains some really generically useful information about how your Trino cluster is being used. It's instead of being an overwhelming amount of information, it's kind of just the 10,000 foot overview of what's going on, which is a useful thing to have in the UI.
Yeah, thanks to Balen from Dune for contributing that, by the way. So
yeah,
very cool.
There's the new preview web UI in development. Preview is maybe a strong word right now. It's kind of just scaffolding, but it will be moving towards being a preview as we continue to build out features there.
I mean, you can view it. It doesn't do anything, but you can view it.
It has buttons that you can click.
That don't do anything either.
Yeah, but they are buttons. So, but we'll be building out features on there. So you can check that out, keep up with development on it, and see what features are going in over time. That's probably going to be a bit of a long haul project, not going to be the kind of thing that's done in the next release or two.
That's an understatement. But
yeah, I think like year to 2 years is probably the time frame for this project.
Yeah,
maybe a little faster if we go quick.
Yeah, and maybe if you're a JavaScript hacker or developer out there that is interested in this kind of stuff, do chime in. There is a roadmap issue and discussions happening in the web UI channel in Trino Slack. So we would love for people interested working on this kind of stuff to reach out and help us.
Then, of course, we added S3 security mapping for the native S3 file system. That's useful if that's something you're using. We like security mapping, just more options. And as usual, this is an important line, especially with releases as big as this one. Tons of performance improvements, bug fixes, and some other minor features have been added. You can go check out the full release notes by clicking on that Trino 454 button when the show notes go live, or just go to the Trino docs and click on the releases. Because this was a pretty beefy release. If you are not on Trino 454 yet and you like updating to the present, this was a good release to update to.
Yeah, the S3 security mapping, by the way, was the second last issue to some degree that rounds out our feature completeness, well, as much as we can tell, on the native file system implementations. The last one is coming in the 455 release, which will enable GovCloud usage on Azure. And we're working towards the whole switcheroo to make the native ones the default, or like make them basically sort of like the required aspect. And that's coming soon. But I think that's enough about releases and chats like that, Cole. We should talk about our guests.
Welcome, Sebastian and Sunka.
Hi there.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah, good to see you again. Obviously, you've been like long-term Trino developers and users over at Stackable in Europe. Have a nice evening over there, by the way, everyone.
Many thanks.
And you've been involved in a whole bunch of things at Stackable, running Trino for your customers, also working on the Open Policy Agent plugin with the folks from Bloomberg, and you presented about that at the Trino Summit, as we mentioned. So you're going to tell us more about all that today, isn't it?
Yes, we will.
Cool. I'm really looking forward to that. Do you want to tell us about yourselves first a bit, like how you got to be in the Trino ecosystem maybe and so on?
I'll let Sebastian go first. He's much more involved than myself.
Yeah. I guess it was basically some sort of a Hive replacement, you could say. Like it was at my previous company where I first got in touch with Trino. We had a big HDFS, we had Hive, and then we basically went Kubernetes native. We had Spark to migrate, which was more easy, I'd say. But like Hive, MapReduce, what about that? And then I tried out Trino and I was happy from the beginning. It just worked with the existing HDFS and Hive Metastore. And yeah, that's like how I personally got to Trino. And yeah, it has lots of different connectors. So, and then like I'm also an Iceberg fan. So that's also great.
Okay, cool. One more other fact about you that I'm going to reveal. And then you can maybe reveal one other one. And first, the one I want to say is you're a mad Rust hacker.
Yeah. I mean, at my company, we're using Rust for basically everything, at least what we are writing ourselves, not including like patching Java tools. That wouldn't make any sense.
Cool. Excellent. Good to have you on board. Thank you. How about you?
Yeah, my story was kind of similar, I guess. I've been working with Hadoop and Hive for, I don't know, a long time, I would say. I'm old. And we sort of founded Stackable and were starting to build a modern alternative to the, not necessarily to the Hadoop stack, but to existing big data distributions. We were looking for a newer, I would say, query engine came across Trino, and Sebastian was already on board at that time. And he said, when I mentioned Trino, he said, "Hey, we were using that. I love it." So we started sort of looking into it, and especially the compatibility with existing Hive Metastores really sold us. So I've been, I don't know, part of the Trino community for not too long, I would say, but I've moved over from sort of like more ancient technologies, if you want to call Hive that.
Awesome.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah. I mean, it's great to have you, by the way. And as you can see also in your like subtitle, you're the founder of Stackable.
Yes, yes, I am. I actually found where to add that subtitle without reconnecting. So that was a nice touch. I forgot that when I initially joined you. We founded Stackable right before the pandemic, actually. So tail end of 2019, I believe. Which, like, then the pandemic ruined a few plans we had, but it all worked out in the end. And basically what we're doing is we're building a modern data platform to sort of run on Kubernetes that gives you more flexibility than what existed previously. We have one or two slides on that, but I'll be brief with the ads, I promise.
That's all good. So I see you have prepared some material to talk about. So do we want to roll into
it? Absolutely. Yep, sure thing.
Awesome.
Right, so Trino and OPA at Stackable. I'll give you a brief look at the agenda that we prepared for today first. What is Stackable? I just sort of spoiled that, but I will be brief and not bore you with the details. Then we have a section on Open Policy Agent, how we actually found it, what we started developing, and how it works. And there will be a demo about that as well. And then we are sort of veering off course a little bit because we brought a topic that's near and dear to Sebastian's heart because he actually started the project, which is Trino LB, which is something that can autoscale Trino clusters on Kubernetes depending on how high the query load is, and so much more. But he'll tell you all about that. He loves this project, and he could probably rant about that for hours on end. And if we have time left, we can talk about lessons that we learned running Trino on Kubernetes. But we'll see how we are for time when we reach that. I'll skip the intros. We already did that, but you can see Sebastian has a much nicer background than myself.
He also has more of a beard on that photo.
He does, yes. He didn't
razor on my vacation, so
last day of vacation then, right? You look very relaxed and
probably, yeah.
Is this Croatia?
It is, yeah, you're right.
Excellent.
Good geoguesser here.
Yeah, we do love us a good round of geoguessing at Stackable. Right, so Stackable in a nutshell, as just mentioned, founded in 2020, somewhere in the vicinity of the pandemic. And what we do is we build an open source data platform. So everything we do is open source as well, which kind of will come up again when we talk about the OPA plugin in a bit. And everything we do is also cloud native, if you want to call Kubernetes cloud native, but I've yet to see a definition that everybody can agree on of the word cloud native. So I'll pick this one, change my mind. We have roughly 20 people spread out all over Europe. Rest of the world is Stackable free for now, but that'll change.
Stackable free, is that a term?
I don't know, I just made it one, I guess. since we were founded in the pandemic, we didn't have an office initially, and we hired all over the place, and now we wouldn't even know where to have an office. So we are 100% remote company. All over Germany, in London, and in Stockholm as well. It's a very nice team. Yeah. We do, as I said, we build a big data platform, but it is open source. So what we actually sell is support for those tools and we evaluate CVEs. We try and get rid of CVEs as they come up in these products. And we basically provide the enterprise-y services around open source software. That's part of our stack, I would say. And mentioning our stack, it is, I would like to say, a sizable stack. I could almost call it a zoo. Most importantly for today, obviously, we have Trino in the middle here, and we have the Open Policy Agent over there. And then what you also find in our stack are sort of the usual suspects back from the old big data days. Like we do provide Hadoop. We do provide Hive because Trino does use the Hive Metastore. We have Superset as sort of dashboard visualization tools, Spark for processing data, NiFive as an ETL tool, Airflow for sort of orchestrating and scheduling workflows. So there's a bit of everything in here, I would like to say. Basically, what we do is we write one Kubernetes operator for each of the logos that you see in this slide. So also one for Trino. And then the sort of the benefit that we try to provide is that we make it feel like a platform instead of a disparate zoo of stuff that where every tool needs their own its own config. And a huge part of that, obviously, is that we would like security to be configured in one place and feel the same across the platform. And that's where the Open Policy Agent comes in. And I'll talk a bit more about that in a second. I did bring a slide about the talk. Manfred, you mentioned it. We did present this at the Trino Summit in December 23. It's right here, together with Pablo at the top left, who isn't here today. But hi, Pablo. I'm sure you'll be watching this at some point in time.
The link to that will also be in the show notes.
Of course it will. Little bit of history. So as I mentioned, we were looking for a sort of unified way to apply ACLs in our platform and came across OPA. So OPA is it pretty much gives you a REST interface. You can stuff there. It applies a set of rules and it tells you yay or nay to the request that you send to Open Policy Agent. So you can sort of keep the side of on the product fairly simple, because you just need to serialize the requests that those products make, ship that off, and then you get a response back. So what you need to do is you need to write authorizers that work with the products themselves. So what we did back then was we started the Trino OPA authorizer, which is that piece of software, which basically runs inside of Trino, takes all the requests, serializes them to JSON, and ships them off somewhere. Doesn't even have to be OPA. And a little bit later, like we used that, it was a fairly, I would say, rudimentary call, piece of code, I'm sorry. And Bloomberg apparently found that at some point in time and reached out to us because we had it under a copyleft open source license. And they said, can't use it if it's under that. So we relicensed it to the Apache license. And then Bloomberg took our code and significantly extended it. I'm tempted to say rewrote it to something that actually works, and opened the first PR for the Trino repository. And I think the review process took, actually it's on here, it's like 5, 6, 7, 8 months. So it was lengthy, but I think it was worth it because it, like, in the end it was actually working properly and good. And then it was merged in January of 24 and has been part of Trino ever since. And it is getting developed further. So in July, Bloomberg again improved it a lot by improving the performance of column masking. So development is ongoing and it is continuing to become better and better. And in due course, I hope to see it become the default authorization interface for Trino, I have to say.
Yeah, that's definitely something that's worth keeping in mind. There's lots more ideas floating around on what to do with OPA and Trino. One thing I wanted to also mention, for those of you that don't know, Open Policy Agent is a kind of very simple application, and it doesn't really have a scope of what to control access for. So it's actually not commonly used in the database world. Do you want to tell us a bit more about where it's often used? Like, it comes out of the Kubernetes ecosystem, right?
It does come out of the Kubernetes ecosystem, exactly. It's also, it is a CNCF project by now, so it was donated to them. And I think initially it was created to extend Kubernetes RBAC, so basically to authorize what happens in a Kubernetes cluster, like the at the application layer, but rather at the Kubernetes layer. So who's allowed to change or do what, because the Kubernetes native RBAC stuff is, you can reach its limits fairly quickly when you not extend that. So that's where it was born, I think. But as I said, it's really, really flexible. It's like, to my mind, it's actually just, I don't know, ACLs as code, because you can pretty much do whatever you want. I don't know, if you want to authorize based on the moon phases, that's probably possible as well. I don't know.
Yeah,
the werewolf, you're not allowed to access your data. Might make sense.
Yeah, cool. So yeah, that's worth mentioning. And it's used in Kubernetes for network and like all sorts of access to those kind of things. So and you and Bloomberg together adapted it to like the relational data kind of scheme
world. Yes, that's exactly
relevant. So that's cool.
But it's not the only OPA plugin we have written. We have written plugins for other tools as well. So in case someone is interested in an HDFS authorizer and wants to upstream it into Hadoop, please reach out. We're happy to change your license. So yeah, that's one of the hard things of saying, yeah, we want to use open policy agent everywhere. Yeah, you need to write the integration to every tool or add the integration to every tool that you're going to use.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for working with the Trino community to get it into Trino. So that's been really good.
Thanks for taking it on. All right. So Trino already had a access control layer, which was the file-based access control. And so writing the authorizer is only one part of the equation, as I just mentioned. That pretty much just serializes the request, ships it off, and then there needs to be a rule engine to authorize that request. And, like, you can just hard code that. That's possible, but cumbersome, I would say. So what we try to do is come up with a sort of like a convenience wrapper around that, where you simply write down who is allowed to do what, and then like there's a bit of extra code that we give you. Again, that's open source as well. Feel free to take and adapt. That applies the like human readable ACLs to whatever request comes in. And when we started out on that, we took a look at what Trino already has, which was the file-based access control, which basically takes a, you can see it in here, a rules.json file. And in there it says this user can read that table or write that table or access this schema or stuff like that. And so basically what we did was we took the schema or the format of that file and translated that into something that OPA could then apply. Well, rather, no, we wrote regular rules that could read that file and authorize in OPA based on this. So what you should be able to do is if you're using the file-based access control thing from Trino, just take that file, stick it into OPA, and the same things should happen or be allowed or disallowed in your cluster. We've not extensively tested whether it's 100% match. I'll be upfront about that here. But if anybody has a complex set of rules that I would like to test that with, please, by all means, do reach out. We are interested in looking at that and seeing whether that works or not.
By the way, could Sebastian or Sönke maybe jump in and explain what Rego is?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I completely skipped over that. Rego is the language that you instruct OPA in what should or should not be allowed. So basically, it's the programming language that you write your rules in Open Policy Agent in. And it's takes a bit of getting used to. I've not yet reached the point of being used to it. Sebastian, I'm sure, has a long time ago because he's worked with it much more. But basically, it's, yeah, you write assertions in this language which say, is this allowed or is this not allowed? And then it takes input, which is what Trino ships for the request. And you can have data, which would then be user X is allowed to access topic or table something in a read, write, or full fashion or stuff like that. And then the Rego rules are pretty much the programming language that tie the input and the data together to reach a decision on whether or not something is allowed.
And Rego is like a declarative language. So you're declaring basically statements, which will be fulfilled by the engine. And it's not imperative that it works like a list from top to bottom, which made it a bit hard for our colleague to implement the file-based access control, because that's basically like a list, work it top to bottom. He needed to do some tweaks there to get it running. But it's declarative, such as you can access any table which starts with the name of your username. Like that would be one declarative statement you can make.
Cool. I have to put Cole on the spot now. He's our English major here. Is it declarative?
Declared, but that's okay. I wasn't going to say anything.
I just wanted to know. And it's like, you know, oh, we have these side tensions are always a good thing.
you're making me do grammar real quick.
We are all just native German speakers here. We have also a clue about English, so you're the man.
Yeah, right. It's three Germans on the call.
And, yeah. Well, I count as Austrian. Excuse me.
Yeah. No, all right. I'm sorry for the respect. Based on how I tried to pronounce the O with umlaut earlier. So
I did all right.
I'll take it.
All right. Sorry for the distraction. Let's get back to Rego.
Yeah, no worries. Please do call me out if I miss something. So this is just a look at it's basically something that could be in the file-based access control. So basically you say these tables, the user admin has these privileges and this schema HR and the table employees, someone else, like whoever it is, has privileges as well. So basically, yeah, this is basically what Sebastian has just mentioned, the user equals current user. So this is how ACLs would look like in the file-based access controller, or even, as it says here, in our compatibility layer as well. Same thing here, user admin, schema owner, or down here, something that I would like to call out, group finance humans resources is allowed to access the schema employees. And so the group is something new, which doesn't come from Trino itself. So basically, this is something that we try to add because basically everybody wants to do group-based access control. You don't feel like adding tens of thousands of users to your ACLs all the time. Usually what you do is you add them to your AD groups, and then AD group, I don't know, employees is allowed to read a table or something. So we needed a way to map users to groups. There wasn't a native one. There's plenty of native implementations, but in that case, they're all over the place, which is what it used to be back in the day. Every tool did its own group resolution. And then one of them did it a little bit differently to the other one. So what we wanted was one single place in our stack where group resolution is done. And to do that, we came up with something called the user info fetcher, which is basically also just a little, not too smart tool, I would say, which we deploy as part of our stack. And then OPA simply calls out to the user info fetcher. And pretty much after Trino or whatever sends the request, Trino OPA extracts the username, ships that off to the to the user info fetcher, and user info fetcher then connects to a backend. Can be multiple systems, and returns whatever that system tells us that user's groups are. Or as you can see here, customer attributes are possible as well. So for example, if you're using Keycloak as the backend, Keycloak can have various attributes that you assign to users. And maybe that is something that you want to authorize based on. Or you can retrieve Active Directory attributes as well. So for example, if a user is assigned to a specific location and you want to authorize based on that location, then you could instruct the user info fetcher to extract that information from AD as well. And all of a sudden you can use that in your ACLs, which makes it a very, very flexible bit of piece of code. And
I'm going to stop you real quick because we have a question from chat.
Yeah.
Tiago asking, is it possible to use OPA to do ABAC instead of RBAC? What I think is attribute-based access control.
Yes. I mean, in principle, as I said, OPA can do anything because you can code your rules. The question in that instance would probably become, where do you get the A from? So if you, I think you said in the question, when you tag a table. So if you can enable OPA to get the tags for the table that you're trying to access, then you can absolutely do attribute-based access control in OPA as well. And what OPA can do, which is actually on the slide here, the call to the user info fetcher, that's just a REST call that OPA makes. So in your rule set in OPA, you can make a REST call. So if you have a service that would give you the attributes for that table, you can absolutely make that call, retrieve those attributes, and as soon as you made that call, you can use those in your rules and do ABAC as well.
Question for Sebastian on that then. Would you be able to potentially tag items like tables and objects and store that tag info in the Hive Metastore?
That's a very good question. Honestly, I don't know it. Maybe you can like
I know that all the tables have like metadata like description and stuff, but I'm not sure if there's like a specific one. Maybe you have to hack around it or something.
I think that the call to OPA is only including like table schema and catalog as a string, but I would need to look at the code, to be honest. I'm not 100% certain on that.
So the answer for our audience is it depends, probably.
Always. But in today's world, quite often there are metadata systems like Data Hub or other things. Like you think Apache Atlas as well, which is basically a declarative system having all the data sets that you have. So that would probably be the logical place to assign tags to data sets. And then these systems usually have REST API that you could probably call. Mm-hmm. So there's thoughts around it, and I'm sure it's already possible, but it'll become more comfortable, I think, because that's like where their journey is going, I think.
Yeah, fair enough. Thank you so much for the question, by the way, Tiago.
Yes, thank you indeed. So just very briefly, how it all works, I've called it the big picture. So basically, these are the ACLs, which is what we just saw, the code where you say user, table, schema, access type of thing. Then we have a little thing called a bundle builder, because what OPA, bundle for OPA is pretty much just a zip file containing everything it needs to do its authorization. And the bundle builder watches these ACL objects in Kubernetes, zips them all up, and then OPA calls the bundle builder and always downloads the current set of ACLs. And then OPA applies those whenever Trino makes a call to OPA. And then when the call comes in, it calls out to the user info fetcher, which in turn resolves the user in whatever backend is configured. We currently have Keycloak as a possible backend. And I've put Active Directory here in with a dashed line or dotted line, because it's getting ready to be merged. I mean, you never know how long it takes once the review process starts, but it is working. And very soon we should be able to resolve groups from Active Directory as well. I mean, we are already able to in a stable version as well. And this is, like, as I mentioned, quite important for us, because in our stack, we don't have just Trino making these calls, but we have plenty of other tools that also talk to OPA. So it becomes a really, really good place to be if you have only one place where rules are applied and group lookups are made. Because then for things like audit logs, you only need to grab the logs from here, not from each and every one of these tools that maybe write them in different formats to different places. So Open Policy Agent for us pretty much became the one-stop shop for every security question or group lookup and all that stuff. And it's really, really brilliant to have that isolated into one place. That makes so many things so much easier.
Yeah, it sounds like that would also make it much less error prone, right? Like
exactly. And it allows us to expose ACLs in a similar format for tools that think in totally different ways. And usually you'd need separate tools to authorize. It's really, really good. It's much better than what I was used to back when I did consulting and had to work with these tools.
Very cool. So one thought comes to mind, yes, just before you jump on. This all looks quite complicated. Doesn't that make it slow?
I'll actually let Sebastian talk about that, because he's in contact with one of our customers who did some performance improvements, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, there are like multiple things. One is Trino doing an HTTP call for basically every action it's taking, which you really want to co-locate the Open Policy Agent with every, at least Trino worker in this case. What we do at our platform is in Kubernetes, there's a concept called the daemon set, where basically state, hey, this Open Policy Agent should run on every physical node in the cluster. So you're not hitting the network. Yeah, you're still like doing a loopback call, so it's still slower than nothing. But that's the thing you really want to do. Mm-hmm. But disclaimer, we did not like thoroughly test benchmark on all of this. It so far just works. So I don't know what the performance hit is. It seems to be acceptable for now. And then the other thing is the performance of the evaluation of the policy in the Open Policy Agent.
So that's the actual Rego script, basically.
Exactly. And a customer actually had problems with that, with the file-based access control, because that's like the imperative walking top to bottom. But he did need to write his own Rego rules in any case, because they have like a complicated system. They are making external HTTP calls all over the place to collect information, who is allowed to do what. And they have like this, okay, a developer can get temporary access right to production to help with a problem, and then he needs to go through a tool which is only like for escalation purposes, and then you need to ask a tool like, hey, can he maybe access what at the moment, something like that. So it's pretty complicated, and they are basically not using this abstraction layer we are talking about. So the abstraction layer is not like the fastest and greatest, I'd say, but just maybe by the nature of walking top to bottom.
Yeah, fair enough. Just for completeness also, Pablo at Bloomberg has been working with us as well. And for example, that batch size fetching has been helping for the performance. And I'm also working with him and other community members to kind of get some documentation going on some of the pitfalls that you can fall into when writing those Rego scripts in the Trino context, because there seem to be some that definitely have a negative performance impact, and we want to make sure we share that with everyone. So stay tuned for that. No ETA.
But one nice thing is when you do something like color masking, which we will show later on, it will not send all your data to OPA and say like, hey, now please mask this data and send it back to me. But instead it will be like an SQL expression, which is then evaluated highly parallel in Trino again. So whenever you talk about like filtering or masking, it's not sending the actual data, but it's still like a costly call to OPA in any case.
Awesome. Cool.
All right. I'll just briefly mention there's a talk of us giving a demo of me actually, and I apologize for the quality of the sound in this recording, of me giving a, we call it end-to-end security demo, which showcases quite a lot of what I have on the next three or four slides, and what Sebastian will also show in just a second. So if you're interested in playing around with this, we have a demo that you can spin up with just one command in a Kubernetes of your choice, and play around with all of this for yourself. That's actually quite nice. I'm going to skip that slide. So basically, we showcase column level security and a few of the other features in that demonstration. So we have a couple of tables. This is a company with a couple of departments: marketing, customer service, and compliance. And what we did was we said, right, the compliance department can also access customer data, but in a restricted fashion, because they only need to run, I don't know, aggregate reports. We never really built a report. It's just a theoretical exercise here. So basically what we said is the compliance department can view the customer analytics schema, but they can't see the first name or the last name or the birth month or day. They can see the birth year, for example, to aggregate over, I don't know, customers over age or something. And for the email address, maybe it's important, like, what domain email addresses are from or something. So they can see the domain, but we will mask the first part of the email address so that they can't actually write an email to that person. So this quite nicely shows how we can remove columns or access to columns from people, and also how masking of data can happen. What that looks like in code is in the column section, you can say first name allow false. So basically just this user can't access that column. And then down here, you can see we do a regex replace on the email address, which basically says keep the first three characters in place and replace anything after that with dashes so that the email address is not in plain text. I'm going over this fairly quickly because Sebastian will actually show that in just a second, and he can probably much better show that like in the actual demonstration and code. But this is how that can be done. And then for row level security, we put in an employee schema, which basically contains information about all the employees of this fictional bank. And then we said, well, every employee can select information about themselves. So when I do a select star on the employee table, I'll always see myself. And for the supervisors, they'll additionally see all the people that report to them. So Sophia Clark, for example, we have here in this example, she has two people reporting to her. So when she runs a select star on the employees table, she sees herself and those two people, which in code then says that you apply the filter and say username equals current user or supervisor equals current user, which is what Sebastian was referring to earlier about being able to declaratively say this. And that actually gives you very, very powerful options of restricting access to data in your Trino system. But with that, enough of the theoretical things. I'll stop talking at you and give Sebastian a chance to actually show you how it works.
Yeah, many thanks, Sönke. I'll try to keep it short because we have like a full, I think, hour video dedicated on this demo. So just a teaser on it. Basically, we have Trino and Superset, And they are also using OpenID Connect, so single sign-on. We are using KeyCloak as identity management system in the demo. And I have configured my Dbeaver, like the SQL client, to point at our Arduino. And if I try to connect to it, that's a very awesome part. And I was like, wow, this is working. That's nice. First time I did it. Because when I open it here, you can actually see in my web browser. Yeah, the demo got the network with us here. Let me quickly close and start Dbeaver again.
Demo gods are never nice.
It's all right.
So give it another try, and there it is. It automatically pulls up my web browser. It's pointing at our KeyCloak instance here, and I will log in as a Daniel King, which is a fictional user in our demo. This is the KeyCloak web interface, by the way. And once I have with that, I'm logged into Twino, and it states of authentication succeeded. So I can come back to Dbeaver, and I'm now logged into Twino. That's very nice. And Sönke has shown some schemas and tables before. Yeah, it's rather quick, but basically we, as Daniel King, we are a compliance member. So compliance not only has access to the compliance analytics, I try to increase it, but I can't, to the compliance analytics schema, but also to customer analytics schema, but not to our tables. There are like some other tables going on, but we are interested in the customer table. So let's try viewing that data. It will again do some OAuth stuff in the background, but you can now see the error message, which I cannot further increase. But it basically states access denied, cannot select from columns A, B, C, D, E, including stuff such as the first and the last name. So that's not allowed. That was basically select star. I can rerun it here as well, and then you get the same error message down here. But what we can do is we can select only the customer ID. And the customer ID is actually, if you look closely, it's not the real customer ID, but it's the SHA hash of the customer ID. Idea here being customer analytics should be able to correlate user actions, but not see the direct customer ID. Because that's, I don't know, they just should not be able to see that.
So that's basically masking it.
Exactly, right? That's masking. And you
can use that for credit cards or date of birth or whatever else.
You can use that for basically anything. There is also the email address in it. Email, see email address. And here you can see it's what Sönke has shown before. It's redacted. You can only see the first two characters. Let's quickly forward in one statement. And yeah, you see, masking is doing its thing. And yeah, because we are Daniel, we can only see the masked environment and only the subset of the columns. If you're ever going to use it, there's this very nice session property that you can set, which basically states like, hey, Twino, it's okay if I don't have access to some tables, just pretend they aren't there at all. And if you set this session property, you can then actually run a select asterisk on the whole table. And it will, example given, stip the month and the date. You can only see the year, not the month and the date. What we are going to do now is, which is one of the benefits, without logging out and logging in again, we can change the group membership in KeyCloak. I'm here now logged into KeyCloak as the administrative user. And we have I'm logged out again, but need to log in again as admin. That's just the session timeout. And you can see here we have these groups going on, the compliance subgroup analytics or the customer service analytics. And let's just quickly pretend that Daniel is joining this group. Maybe he gets like half an hour access to a production system, or you can think of any scenario you want. But let's basically add Daniel to the customer service group. So he now should be able to see more tables. So let's quickly press F5. So there is some caching going on. You can configure it. It's loosely 60 seconds, but cache is invalidated now. So you can see there are actually more tables. And if we now select the customer ID and the email address again, you can see he now has access to the clear text customer ID and email address as well. And then like a select asterisk will bring up all columns because it basically now has access to all columns. And yeah, that's like one nice thing. The user info fetcher will always be invoked. He will quickly check the permissions in Keycloak, and then we can also kick Daniel out again of the group. Yeah, it will take a few seconds for the cache to propagate, but in like a few seconds, you will lose access to your data again. That's basically a small subset of the demo. And I mean, looking at the time, I think I would move on. And
yeah, that's very cool. So you're running all this locally here mostly?
This is actually like the Twino, the Keycloak, and there's also Superset dashboards and stuff. They are running on the cloud at, in Germany, but the demo would also run on my local machine. It's just like I'm stressing that demo got enough already. But it should also run like on AWS, Azure, like whatever your favorite Kubernetes
program. Or your laptop.
Or your laptop. Exactly.
Very cool. Seems like an amazing feature to have all this masking and stuff on the fly there. And obviously also for different users. So very cool.
Yeah. That's very nice. Very nice like combination effort of all the tools playing together.
So Keycloak, by the way, that's also open source, yeah?
Yeah, I honestly, I don't know about the license, but it is, yeah.
Okay.
Maybe it's an Arduino license, but I hope.
I believe it's Apache license, and isn't it a CNCF project as well? I'll check. Keep talking. I'll interrupt you.
All right. Then let's quickly jump back to the slides. So that was basically the OPA part of the talk, I'd say. Yeah, that's how you can like stackable CTL, which is our command line utility, demo install. That's what I did this morning. And then with stacked list, you can get a list of all the stuff which is deployed. There's actually an HDFS running for data storage below. We choose that because we have Kerberos there and we are doing impersonation. And have a look at the talk if that's interesting to you.
So Keycloak is an incubating CNCF project and has the Apache license.
Cool. Nice. And you can also deploy it in front of your OpenLDAP or Active Directory. Yeah, details, I guess.
Very cool. The power of open source.
So now we're pivoting to Trino LB, yeah?
Exactly. That's the plan. Yeah, Trino LB development, yeah, around October of 2023. It was like just before the first official release of Trino Gateway. So it missed it a bit. But it has, I think, like slightly other goals. First off, it doesn't have any GUI at all. So it's like less user-friendly. There's no OpenID Connect and stuff going on. But one important requirement was that you can queue queries in case the Trino clusters are not able to handle them yet, which was technically a bit more than, okay, let's just intercept the first HTTP call. But instead, Trino LB is basically faking that it's a Trino cluster and it's doing like the usual API setter and the round trips and everything. But this way, it can queue queries until Trino has either enough space left so that you can put another query on it, or like you can have this scenario that you, next thing, auto-scale entire Trino clusters, load and time-based. And let's say you have like three different groups, like routing targets, and one routing target can have zero clusters by default. And when like, you can say we have S, M, and L clusters, and you don't want to pay for an L cluster to be running 24/7. You can say like, hey, if an L or XL query comes in, please queue it, spin up a whole entire XXL cluster only for this specific query. When the cluster's up and running, submit the query to it, and then wait for configured like graceful 5 minutes or something like that, and then throw the cluster away again, which is, queuing in combination with auto-scaling. So basically, both are needed to have such a scenario. Then also one important piece is the performance of the system, because a customer of us had the problem that like many queries were submitted in parallel in a big bulk. And the coordinator was basically going nuts, just handling the API traffic. What's my query doing? How is it going? Is it progressing? And it's basically keeping this basically HTTP loop busy. So it's horizontally scalable, and it also is highly available. It doesn't have any state. The default persistence, which I personally would recommend, is a Redis system, which should be pretty low latency. I'd hope so. But there's also like a Postgres persistence if you want to use that instead.
So yeah, migrating that to Valky yet?
No, I didn't. No, didn't cross my mind yet, to be honest.
For those of you that know, don't know, Redis changed the license, and Valky is the pure open source fork now, or one of them actually. So it's interesting.
See how it goes.
Also, for complete transparency and interest, I'm obviously involved in Arduino Gateway, leading that effort to some degree, and we've had extensive discussions, Sebastian and me, when he started that, and the LB, and the goals of the LB and Gateway are very similar. Sebastian was just too fast to jump onto the Arduino Gateway bandwagon and super hyper efficient on getting this all going in Rust, and so he's running with the Arduino LB thing. Ultimately, I think the projects have very similar goals and will probably end up doing similar things, but yeah, things are different, and like it's amazing what you got going there with Arduino LB, Sebastian.
Yeah, absolutely 100% agreed. I mean, like, yeah, these are all like nice goals, but it's missing some other nice features which Arduino Gateway is having. And yeah, as I've mentioned, like the time starting, it was like, okay, we want something very, very quick, and Arduino Gateway just got the first release out, I think like a week after or something like that.
So, yeah, and yeah, we're still a while away from those features. So
yeah, but maybe they're also like not as good as like if larger, like there is a much larger user base for Arduino Gateway than for Arduino LB, so there are probably lots of bugs and things to fix. So yeah, if you want to give it a try, you can be like an early adopter, I'd say.
Yeah, no, I think it's amazing. So very cool.
Yeah, and then also like you have this routing. So basically, I hinted if with the small, medium, and L clusters, which was kind of what we have a customer with specific requirements. So we basically modeled it somewhat after the requirements, and for that, the idea is to have different routing strategies. So you could look at the client tag header, which is like easy peasy. Or we also have a cost estimation tool. So you can have this explain analyze, send it to the Arduino cluster, get a result back of the estimation, and then put it in a corresponding cluster sizing based on this estimation. Or to be full flexible, we also have a Python script router where you basically, hey, here's a Python code, just execute that, and the output, like the returned thing by the Python script, it will decide where the query is going. So you can go all in and do crazy routing stuff if you really want to. I haven't tested reaching out to OPA. Maybe that's the thing. So, okay. So yeah. Anyway, and there, like all of the persistence routing and scaling stuff is behind an interface. So you should be able to plug in your own routing or persistence or stuff.
Awesome. So for the, well, you go and I'll ask later.
Okay. Yeah. I have to admit, I'm just learning a bit at the time, but I think we'll skip the lessons learned part and then can at least take a time for Arduino LB. Yeah, there's one screenshot. You can see it's like from Tenerife actually. So it's a few months old again. What is this diagram here showing? So basically, I submitted some queries to Arduino LB, and we are having three cluster groups. We have S, M, and OIDC, because I was testing if it correctly sends HTTP headers in case you are doing OpenID Connect. That's not going on here, so it's just like one cluster running and that's it. But the S and the M ones, they are auto-scaled. The S one, like it's just some benchmarking thing. The S one has zero clusters in standby, and the M cluster has one and normal operations. And then some queries were submitted to the M. You can see here like 60 queries or something like that. They were queued because I said, I think a cluster can take, I think, 5 queries or something like that. And in case it would submit more than 5 queries to the cluster, it queued them instead. And then, yeah, the queries were processed, went down again. And you can see like 50 were queued. I said, once you have 10 queries queued or something like that, you can pick yourself a new cluster. So it spun up a second M cluster to handle all the load. It did its work, and then it scaled it down again because there were nothing to do left. And the S one, actually, I submitted probably 50, 60 queries as well. And it actually started an on-demand cluster. It was running, and after 5 minutes, it shut down again. And then like here were like 300 queries queued and basically doing the same thing, scaling up from 1 to 2. And everything's finished, scaling down again. One interesting thing as well is OpenTelemetry tracing. So it was my first time using tracing. I'm very happy with it. I can recommend it. And you're looking at the screenshot of Jaeger. And it has trace propagation to Trino. So the Trino project, like, I don't know, 1.5 years or something like that ago, started emitting OpenTelemetry traces as well. And if you set the correct HTTP header, you can see, like, this is a flow where Trino LB is asked, how is my query doing? And it's actually queued in Trino, not in Trino LB, but in Trino, not to confuse that. And basically, you can see it checks in the persistence, hey, where is that query running? Because it needs to contact the correct coordinator. And then you see ask for query state, it hands off to Trino, Trino is doing something, it gets back, and then it stores the result in the persistence, what's the current state. And then last but not least, change next URI to Trino LB, so that the client next time asks Trino LB again. Yeah, and like in the future, maybe there are more traces from Trino coming on for this call, and then you can have like a nice interleaved view of things happening in your cluster, which I think is very nice. Yeah, and I think it, like with 4 minutes or something left on the clock, I'd say
it's not that urgent.
Manfred, I think you can then ask your question.
Well, just go to the over next slide, like the lessons learned, because that's kind of like where this leads to some degree. My question was around how you, like you say, Trino LB scales, auto scales the cluster, but it's not actually doing it itself, right? Like, can you talk about what's actually happening there?
I can show one quick demo, because that's a quick demo. I have a cluster here running. And in here, at Stackable, we have a thing called custom resource definitions, where you basically say, like, hey, Stackable, please give me a Trino cluster. And I have defined actually 3 Trino clusters here, 1S and 2M. But this is infrastructure as code. It's basically a loop. I can say I want 20S clusters. It's just a number in a Helm chart, basically, and because all of this is, yeah, infrastructure as code. So you need to actually provision your clusters beforehand. So you have a maximum number of clusters that you can use. But on the other hand, they don't cost you anything. And what Trino LB is actually doing, it's turning them on and off on demand. So you can say the M2 cluster currently is the status available is false because it's not there. It doesn't have its replicas. And that is because the cluster is stopped. And Trino LB is just turning them on and off. We can actually inspect that. I can send a query to, there's our real credentials in the internet. Psh, don't tell anyone. We can send the query to Trino LB, and we can set the client tag S. So we are saying, please send us to an S cluster. And if we say show catalogs, you can see it's queued in Trino LB. So not queued in Trino, but in Trino LB. And if we switch back, you can see it's now spinning up an on-demand S cluster. But spinning up, it's basically re-enabling it. And that's basically what is behind the interface as well, where you can plug in your own infrastructure as code system or whatnot system. And the functions are basically like, is that thing turned on? Yes or no? And please turn it on or please turn it off.
And then obviously also like, please scale it up or scale it down, I guess. And like, is this all working via Helm charts or an operator or both? Like you mentioned Helm before.
I basically use Helm to deploy the Trino clusters, but it's just that I can have like an easy 4IN1 to 20 loop, but You don't need to use Helm or something like that. It's basically like using Stackable resources in Kubernetes. And all what Trino LB itself is doing, it's talking to Kubernetes. So it's actually not even talking to the, like, yeah, it's sending traffic, but it's not talking to the Trino cluster, but it's talking to the Kubernetes cluster. And in Stackable, you have ways of saying, like, press a button to stop and start. And Trino LB is only pressing these buttons. And then our operator is doing deletion of pods and logs and volumes and all of that in the background.
Okay, so you have an operator that does that then.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
And awesome. In principle, I think the implementation of all those buttons that it presses, you put behind an interface so that this would be extensible to work with anything else that deploys a Trino.
Exactly. You could do an HTTP call to spin up a whole GKI, Google Kubernetes Engine thingy and do stuff there. Like, you can do anything you want to behind cool. that interface.
We'll definitely have to pull you into the next Trino Gateway DevSync, because that's exactly where we're at. We're trying to sort of like figure out and define the interface, how we want to do that in Trino Gateway. And rather than reading the Trino LB source code, we'll just pull you in to talk to us.
Yeah. There's also some sort of documentation on it. You can give it a read and stuff. And the different thing I've prepared, it should also be very quick. If I remove the extra thing. So we are now sending 500 queries to Trino LB, and it's also broken. Nice. Okay. Never mind. I think the IP address has changed in the background. So let's pretend that didn't happen. But I think it actually did happen, because it's spinning up the second M cluster. So something is broken, but at least the queries went to Trino LB. It noticed, hey, I have a backlog of queries, and it spun up a second. Like, it enabled a second instant. It's itself did not create the instant, it just turned it on because it saw the demand for it.
And then these would run, and then once the queries are all processed, it would exactly. shut down that second cluster again.
You can see the S cluster is now shut down again. I think it's like a 5-minute grace period or something like that, but you can configure that, whatever makes cool. sense.
Yeah, very interesting, very impressive. I love it. Really cool. So what are the lessons you learned?
Yeah, so the lessons we learned. First off, we don't run any production Trino clusters ourselves, to be honest. I did it at my previous company, but not here. But our customers do. And they complain if like Trino breaks every week or so. And yeah, we are using an operator to manage Trino on Kubernetes, which is basically a piece of code interacting with Kubernetes and taking care of your clusters. And you basically state like, hey, stackable operator, I want a Trino. It has 5 workers that size, and please this 3 catalogs. That I think should be sufficient for here. There's also documentation stuff. And one thing we learned is like, you, for my person at least, you should really try to avoid any coordinator restarts, because like a coordinator restart kills basically all running queries on that particular coordinator. And one thing we have done to make this less of a problem is we have a flag, don't touch this cluster at all costs. Like, if I scale it up, if I scale it down, if I give it more memory, I don't care, just don't touch it at all. I can always then enable that reconciliation flag again, so that it applies the changes that are accumulated over the time. Yeah, potential future work. I mean, like, there is like issues older than time on the Trino project. To it's a complicated thing to maybe get some sort of queue, shared queue failover scenario stuff. But from our side, we are also thinking about adding some sort of maintenance windows, so that you basically enter this don't touch this cluster at all costs during nighttime and then leave it again in the next morning or something like that. And then again, but that's like for planned downtimes. Like, planned downtimes are fine, because you can do something else, which would also theoretically work, is whenever a coordinator sets down, he has a so-called pre-stop lifecycle hook, I think, where you can basically say like, okay, I'm going to shut down, and I have a Trino LB or a Trino gateway in front, and I say that system, please don't schedule any new queries to me, then wait until are finished. Then the coordinator can safely exit and do its restart. And once it starts up again, it can re-enable its backend in the LB gateway again.
Yeah, that's also the same approach. You can do that with 2 clusters that are identical, then you can basically have 0 downtime completely for the users. And that's also one of the approaches for HA that obviously also works with the Trino Gateway. And that's another good approach that you can also use for version upgrades, for example, where you like have 2 identical clusters, one with the new version, one with the old one, do some testing and all that kind of stuff. So that's really useful.
That works perfectly fine for like planned updates and stuff. So you can totally recommend that for that.
Also, you mentioned this ages-old HA ticket. It's ages-old, but the discussions are still happening, and there might be some work coming in the future towards that as well. So we'll see how that goes. But
so old, but not inactive.
exactly. Yeah, I mean, it still requires, like, I was used to at my previous company, we had like bare metal Kubernetes, and the operator said, when I'm going to send you a signal that your pod should get off of this node, you have, it depends, but like between 5 and 10 minutes to get off a node. In other case, I'll hardly reboot the node anyway. And like, if you have queries running for an hour or two, there is no way of migrating them in as quickly as 5 minutes. So yeah, it still has some problems, like it's thing. Still not the 100% solution.
Yeah, I mean, those kind of problems are also self-inflicted then ultimately, right? Like,
yeah. But there's nothing like the DLB or the gateway can really
can necessarily do. Yeah.
Yeah, I just keep going. You can like say time's up at any point of time.
So good.
Yeah, then graceful shutdown of workers. Basically, it's, hey, that's a thing. It's out there. Just use it. It's not that hard. If you don't do it, like a worker restart, if there are like intermediate results of the query, things will error communicating with remote tasks or something like that, if you know that message. Turn on graceful shutdown. It just isn't that hard. And also, it's even better to use fault-tolerant execution so that individual worker failures can easily be tolerated, and then spooling and all that kind of nice stuff going on. So yeah,
we do it by default. Performance trade-off there, though.
But yeah.
Resilience is good, so.
But there are caveats, so please check documentation before.
Cool.
Last code. And then I think last but not least, the pod placement. When you have like multiple servers, racks, data centers, rooms, we think, but that's also kind of a question, that it makes sense to try to spread the workers among all of this topology nodes, so that when your individual, I don't know, rack goes out of power, not all worker nodes are lost. But that also like increases inter-tree-node traffic. So it's also, we are making the assumption that you're already doing as big as tree-node workers as you can do on a given hardware node. And that's also kind of looking in the direction of the community. What do you think about this approach? Yeah, it increases the like shuffle traffic, but on the other hand, it's a better safe and sorry bet on the availability. And when the shuffle traffic is a real thing, then like customers are more advanced, so that they can actually point one here, they can customize it to match whatever topology they have, like all my racks are not very interconnected or something like that.
I guess.
And then you also have
response there is have a good network, then it'll just work.
Yeah. Well, I think the typical answer also applies. It depends, right? Like it depends a lot on what you need and what your requirements are for uptime and that kind of stuff, and like how stable your like networks are. The general guidance is still that you should have multiple Trino workers, like not just two or so, right? Like have more than that. But then don't go crazy and have hundreds if you don't have the need for it. And it's probably better to have less that are sizable rather than small one. It like Trino is not the typical stateless system where each individual worker should be a small machine. Like 64 gig of memory is totally fine. Like big memory and like just have like five or so of those is better than having 500 like eight gigabit phones like that. That'll be a bad idea, right? For example. So all that still applies, right? So
yeah. All right. And I think we missed the thank you for listening slide, but thank you for listening.
Oh, we'll have some of those. And thank you. It's more like thank you for presenting. Sebastian, that's been super interesting and very educational, I think. I'm sure Cole agrees and the audience.
Thanks for having us.
All so right. Anything else? Where can people find more? Stackable.tech.
Stackable.tech, stackable.de. You can find stuff. Reach out. We have a Discord server. Reach out there. And of course, like most of our work and online life is on GitHub. So github.com/stackabletech. You can find us there. And also all the code we talked about and the demos and pretty much everything that was here today, you can probably find somewhere in our GitHub organization.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And of course, you can also hassle both Sönke and Sebastian on Trino Slack, because they hang out there too.
So again, thank you all for being on the Trino Community Broadcast. Manfred and I are going to wrap up with just a couple other things.
Couple of other things. What are those? First of all, there's resources. As always, in the show notes, we will have a little bit more information. There is also the links for that video, the source code repository, the Stackable website, and then the longer demo video. That's all there. But we also want to talk about a few other things, Cole. What's happening?
Yeah, Trino Summit 2024. We've mentioned it before, but it is still happening. It is still out there. The call for speakers is open. It's a two-day event, which means that we have a lot of freedom to kind of accept talks ranging from very beginner to extremely sophisticated. So if there's anything you've worked on Trino-related that you want to share with the Trino community, submit a talk. We'd love to hear about it. We're going to be pretty generous with acceptances. As long as it's connected to Trino and is contributing something that people may not have heard about, we'd love to have it at Trino Summit.
Yeah, you can get down and dirty in the code or to high level on how to use it and anywhere in between.
Yeah, so all audiences, we're welcome to submit. We'd love to see more talks. Also, Trino Community Broadcast 65 already on the calendar, where we're going to be talking about the new Exasol connector.
Yeah, another talk with people talking in Germany for some reason. So it's going to be really good. That's a new connector that was merged, I want to say, less than 5 releases ago. I don't actually know specifically, but 450-ish something.
I can go look this up real quick.
Not to matter too much. super episode. Very interesting. I love how OPA and like Trino LB, Trino Gateway and all this innovations happening in the ecosystem. Trino is rocking on, and at Trino Summit, we'll share more, and we will see you on Trino Slack, Trino Community Broadcasts, Trino Contributor Calls, and so on.
452, by the way, so only 3 releases ago, but we're looking forward to that. Thank you all for tuning in. As always, you know where to find us. Manfred's kind of gone over it. Show notes will have links. Description on YouTube will have links. But other than that, until next time, we'll see you later.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Trino Community Broadcast, brought to you by Starburst Data.